All right, we're here.
We're here, and you're in the hot seat today, which is so cool because there's no pressure on my end. I get to interview you, and it's an honor to do so, man. Thank you for allowing me to do this. And to be quite frank, I know you've done this in the past, so I'm interested in mixing it up a little bit and getting to know you, not only on the canine side, but there's so much to talk about, man. So, you know, thanks for giving me this opportunity.
Yeah, it's, you know, like I was saying, it's different for me because I'm usually the interviewer, and only so far I've had my good friend Pete Stevens do an interview with me before on here. But the reason why I liked it is because it's somebody totally different. I don't know you as well, so you're going to come at things with different perspectives, so I'm happy to do it. So let's get after it.
Yeah, this is awesome. I mean, from 5 years we've been doing this, or you've been doing this, I should say. That's quite an accomplishment. And you've interviewed people from all different walks of life, from different disciplines, from different countries, you know, from Pete Stevens to Mike Kamisik to Simon Prince to Lauren DeGreef. You've interviewed so many people. What is it like looking back at those 5 years as kind of a snapshot? What is it like on your end looking at that as kind of holistically?
That's a fantastic question. It's been quite a journey, I would say, both from the journey of getting to know people and interview people and do things that I never thought I would do, or get to have some cool conversations that I never thought I'd get to have, to then also grow as a creator, which is not something I ever thought I would do. Like, I never looked at social media, and, you know, I was off the grid in a sense for a number of years where I didn't do any social media whatsoever. And then coming into it, having to learn. And then once the podcast got popular, really having to learn. I had to, like, it's been a whole different degree I've gotten now with videography, doing audio, like learning the podcast stuff. And, you know, I laugh, I get some reviews every now and then on the podcast, like, oh, Cameron says, too much. And, agrees with people only for the things that he, you know, and I laugh because I'm like, look, I have no background in media, no background in videography or photography or anything like that. So I am as rough around the edges as possible, only because I didn't know anything. I was just a dog guy. And then I got into this world and I've made every kind of mistake possible. You know, I've tried to get better in interviewing. It's easier said than done. You know, there's an art to it. There's some people who are just naturally really good at interviewing people. I can't say that I'm one of them. As far as like being a host, you know, all the proper etiquettes of when to say something, when not to say something, you know, it's always been a learning process for me. So, and then over the past 2 years with the growth of video, it's crazy. You know, I never thought I'd be sitting in a studio like this ever. Right. And now here we are. So that 5 year journey has been both professionally rewarding in the sense of the people I got to be around and interview and talk to and learn from. And then personally with the, you know, learning something totally new that I never thought of, never thought I'd learn videography. But now photography and videography have become a hobby. So now I have an outlet for my dog stuff.
Now that's awesome. And you know that I do a little bit of podcasting, really. Maybe once a month or something like that. Not very often.
Sure.
And it is a learning curve. I want to be a good student. So interviewing people is something that comes natural in that way, because I want to elicit information from people to get some type of knowledge, whatever that may be. So definitely a learning curve. Feel you there. 5 years in the making. I think you're doing pretty good, though. And all things fair. All right. So go ahead.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, man. So you've got so many videos on YouTube, so much content online, literally years worth of content. So I want to kind of do kind of like hitting the highlights of some of the things that, at least for me selfishly, are really resonated with me, topics that I really enjoy. And so I'm going to hit on these topics, take it as far or in depth as you want. The purpose of this would be like, if there's somebody out there in the world that doesn't know Cameron Ford and our industry, kind of give them an idea of these hot topics and your take on them. You ready?
Okay. Yeah,
all right.
Go ahead.
So delayed conditioning versus simultaneous conditioning. About a year ago, you did a video on this, talking about your dopamine box, you know, odor coming first or reward coming first. Odor is the pathway to reward as opposed to the reward being a pathway to the odor. Talk to us about that.
Yeah. So obviously many, many years I do like everybody's done. I've done the simultaneous conditioning where I have had reward with the odor together and it worked. I never really questioned anything. And then I was around Dr. Lucia Lazarowski and Nathan Hall and a few others. And they had asked, you know, kind of testing, not necessarily testing me on purpose, but just asking questions about my understanding of how to get a dog to understand odor more clearly. And that brought up delayed conditioning, which was something I hadn't heard of before. I've heard of different other learning models, but delayed conditioning was not necessary. And don't get me wrong, I was doing it, and we all do it. We do it later on. Once we've, in detection, we've removed the reward later on, technically that's delayed conditioning when you're at the dog's at odor. While they're at odor, the reward happens. But what I'd done, which is everybody else has done, which was in the beginning to get the dog to want the odor, I pair the thing that they want with it. And what they had showed me was you're just doing a 2-second difference. You're just having odor, the stimulus, the thing you want to find to be present. And while the dog is investigating it or smelling that, then reward happens. And there is actually, the science behind it, stronger psychological attachment to the odor because the odor predicted the reward, not the reward and odor together, where the reward might overshadow the odor. Yeah. And there's lots of dogs still figure this out despite the perfect, you know, psychological association. But what I got to learn firsthand was I was creating odor addicts without realizing it. And then now what I share with some people or I do at classes is like, okay, what's the drug user? Let's just take someone who's addicted to heroin. What are they addicted to? Are they addicted to the heroin? Or are they addicted to the experience the heroin brings them? And of course, it's chasing the dragon. It's the experience. It's the high.
Right.
So how did they get that? Well, the heroin, the stimulus comes first, and then the psychological effect comes after. It's similar in delayed conditioning. The stimulus, which would be our target odor, predicts this great experience based on that reinforcer, whether it be food, toy, whatever you choose to use. That's the part that's, you know, unique to that dog or what you're going to use. But that is where the experience that the dog really wants comes from. So that connection is an amazing thing. And it enhanced my detection game and really helped me eliminate a lot of issues. Now, don't get me wrong. There's still going to be times where I will utilize a simultaneous conditioning method. Sometimes a dog just – it's a better connection for a dog. Some dogs, you know, just may not make the connection quick enough. Or sometimes where I've come across, a dog's already had some kind of previous training with simultaneous conditioning. So I'll go back and speak its language, use it, but I'll use it sparingly. I'll use a term that my friend Pat Stewart uses, as little as possible, but as much as necessary. So I'll do that scenario or that simultaneous conditioning as little as possible, but as much as necessary to get to the point where I can see, oh, okay, my dog understands it. And now I'll just fade into a lot more of the stimulus, the odor being present first. And then while they're in odor, reinforcement happens. And then that connection usually happens pretty quickly. But that's kind of how it happened in my personal experience with it. And it's what I try to share now is because, like anything in what we do, things evolve. And this was one of those evolutions where we took a learning model that's already proven in every other form out there of behavior and things like that, and apply it just slightly better or more efficient to what we do. But I don't say throw out all the other things. I don't say throw out simultaneous conditioning, only do delayed. I say try to do delayed first as your one of your ways to do it. And you can also use simultaneous because there's going to be times where that is a better option than delayed for that particular dog. So, yeah.
Right on. And I love the fact that you're identifying there's still times where it may be beneficial for the dog for multiple reasons.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
So, what about the topic of indication or odor? What should be most important? Yep. That is such a unique topic. I love it because I've seen it in my own career. Dogs really, really dependent on giving some type of response as opposed to really being obedient to odor. So please hit on that.
Yeah. So odor, I mean, if I don't have odor, then there's no indication, right? So I want odor to be the most important thing that the dog is doing. So like most people, I would say searching is our primary thing that's developmentally trained initially. We focus heavily on searching and searching techniques and searching experiences and things like that. But that in that stage is where we start bringing in target odor, which so as you already kind of know, I have a stepped system that just helps me. And then, of course, being a cop in the military, having things that have a very clear step system makes it better for a lot of other people too. So step zero is what I refer to our developmental stage. So that's where we're doing play development, search development, communication, building my condition reinforcers. And then once that's all solid and I've proofed a lot of those concepts, my dog has a condition reinforcer, aka a marker. That means reward's going to be in front of them. Then I have another condition reinforcer. That means reward's back at me. So depending on my situation and where my dog's at, my dog actually holds position better because they can't predict is reward coming in front of them or back at me. So they actually become more resilient in whatever position that I want them in. Because one of those two things could be happening. So similar to those when we're doing obedience, when we do a down stay, let's say, and we walk out 50 feet, we don't always turn around and call the dog back to us. Because if we, of course, we do that, they're just going to run to us. So having the, in that kind of concept, the obedience concept, we reward in location or in position. So I do the same thing in detection. This is an evolution I've gone through. You know, I did the initial always paying directly at odor, and then I learned markers and started using that. And then, of course, as I got better and being around Michael Ellis really pushed me into understanding how to do that better with a lot of his guidance. And like the class we have going on right now, we have a detection dog school going on right now. And then a lot of cops in the class are like, holy cow, this is making my life so much easier because the dog becomes more steady. Because reward could happen in front and there's no, the dog's not using the tells from the handler. And then those, the dog just goes, okay, I know I'm going to hear one of two sounds. One means reward's happening there. The other one means I go to you. So circling back, you know, going way off your question, but back to it, odor is the most important part because the position, whatever the dog is, whatever the indication position is, becomes irrelevant if the dog is understanding, I find target odor, the ideal position I want you in is whatever you choose. That gets the most reinforcement. Let's just use sit because we know most people that's a common one. But we also understand there are many operational conditions where sit may not work as cleanly as we had hoped in training. Right. So does it mean we automatically don't know where odor is at because the dog didn't sit? Of course not. Handlers read their dogs, can know all of the pre-indication behaviors that occur, the changes of behavior that occur. And if the dog can't physically get into the sit for any number of reasons due to the environment, they can still very much read their dog's behavior and commitment to the odor, regardless of the position, and know that the target's there. So, which is why we focus heavily on odor recognition, understanding odor in a ton of different conditions with a ton of different mixtures and so forth. And then going into, ideally, if you do this position, this is even better. But if you can't, I will still understand and reinforce you to a level if you do it in this way. But the most important is that you're, lack of a better term, sticky to the odor. You're staying there in regardless of whatever position, but you're there. You're expressing to me through a strong change that basically if anybody was standing around us could go, oh, your dog's telling you something. There's something right there. That's the important part.
So what would you say to somebody who's having an issue with that? Because I see that a lot where the dog is more focused on cues that the handler may be giving and thinking, how I get my toy is a series of events that has to happen, and then I get my toy. How would you go about, I know it's hard to do in a podcast sometimes talking about it, but how would you go about explaining how to help somebody through that process?
It's again, it's a very common question, like you said. So what I do, and again, because I just label things in steps, I go to what I call my step one, which is just, it's one thing, it's got odor in it. The dog only has to do whatever the trained behavior is I want it to do, and then maintain that position for variable durations of time and despite the things that I'm doing. So what's nice is it's low criteria, low variables. So therefore, the dog can only has to do this thing. It does this thing, holds it, and then my job is to start proofing the snot out of the dog with my movements, whether I'm standing still, whether I'm moving, cartwheels, clapping my hands, reaching in my pocket, right, whether my toy is in my hand. And again, this is where the use of conditioned reinforcers takes that up another notch, because now the dog realizes, oh, I don't care about all those other movements or other things. All I have to do is listen for either this signal or that signal. And that really clears. That's exactly what's happening right now with the officers going through the school, is their dogs had been, because where is reward at? When you're working, whether you're operational or training, where does your dog expect reward? Handler. They know it's rewards on you. So after X amount of time and the dog knowing you have the reward and X amount of bad habits we have as handlers or trainers, the dogs start taking the shortcut of the indication being nice and focused and direct towards odor, to deteriorate, to cutting the eyes, to turning the head, to turning all the way around. And reinforcement kept happening in many cases, regardless of those positions. So to the dog, yes, I know I'm supposed to find it. Yes, I'm supposed to look at it for a second, but I am so excited to get my thing. I'm going to turn around and look at you. And then the handlers react in any number of ways, and or their tells expose what's going to happen next. So we focus in a very controlled environment. And that step one is the mechanics of the handler, which is mark, then move. Yeah. So they don't have to do anything else. All you got to do is say your word or make whatever sound you do. And then you move and take your toy out or do whatever. Or I also do in this phase is the toy's right here in my hand, or the food or whatever you're using. It's right mm-hmm. here. But the only way you can get it is by focusing or doing whatever I want you to do here at odor. And when you do that, I'll signal to you that you're correct and you can have this. And that cleans up a lot of those errors. That's exactly what's happened the past 48 hours at the school, is lots and lots of reps where we're breaking down that step for those handlers. And you can see the dogs go, oh, okay. What's even funnier, though, is there's new dogs in the group, and the new dogs pick it up super fast because there's nothing right. that ruins no that. And the joke I make to everybody to relate to it, I said, look, I didn't get fat overnight. I sure as hell ain't going to get skinny overnight either. So these things that we have to undo take longer than first doing it. When the slate's clean, it's very easy to do. But when the slate is got some history to it, it's a little bit harder to do. So that's where we have to break it down into its simplest form, work on it that way, and then we start adding some more variables to it. As if I raise a change of variable, I'm lowering the criteria, so I don't make for a long duration. That's another thing we run into many times, is some will say, ooh, my dog knows how to do a good alert, but when they change a condition, they still expected the previous known, you know, really good behavior. But when the variable happened, the dog doesn't quite understand, and therefore that behavior wasn't as strong as you thought because the variable changed. So you have to be willing to and understand, I got to lower something, so I'm going to make the criteria easier. So if you just acknowledge odor when I've changed something pretty important, then I'm going to reward you faster. But once you understand it, I can start increasing variables and adding things to it and changing duration and things like that.
So talking about duration, I've seen mm-hmm. certain dogs after a certain amount of time, like an internal clock in their head, that they think yep. they're going to get rewarded. And sometimes it doesn't happen mm-hmm. within that clock. So often they'll get frustrated, or sometimes worse, they'll offer a different behavior, leave odor and go somewhere else. Where do you think that stems yep. from, and how do you fix that?
Lots of things. Number one is the predictability of the reward from the handler. That's obviously number one. And the handlers, we're humans, so we do a lot of things very predictably. Yeah. And it's funny, you know, just for those who want to test this for themselves, just as a joke or just for gee whiz, is when you run a stopwatch, tell somebody, I want your dog to hold for 3 seconds, but you mark when you think it's 3 seconds. And you'll be surprised how many people will mark at like just past a second and think it's 3 seconds. And this is where, you know, to kind of take this to another level, but addressing your question. So Dr. Nathan Hall has developed these boxes that are computerized, and there's a little bit, I won't call it AI, but there's also some AI pieces coming into it. And what's super humbling and what's amazing is these computerized boxes train a dog on odor with a solid indication in about a day or 2 days with no bleed over of issues of dog, you know, turning around, looking at it's not, because the computer doesn't have emotion, and the computer also is very deliberate about time frames. It knows if I go up, I'll go down. And it will not really, it knows what 3 seconds really is versus an excited handler. So because of the lack of human predictability aspects, because the dogs know us, they know everything about us, they're bound to pay attention to the slightest hand movement. Well, in that situation with the computerized boxes, there's none of that. So there's no muddied waters. The dog is really clear about, oh, okay, got it. I find the one, stay here, the thing will beep, and then I'll get my reward. Hmm. And the bigger problem that you brought up was when it comes to duration is we don't vary duration enough. And sometimes we get too greedy and we go longer than we should. And then the dog gets some level of reinforcement, even if they were to kind of break position, the handler will jump in and help and then reward anyways, versus understanding there's a time where we, like these, again, using the Kliss class as an example, they're also learning reset criteria. If this happens, instead of waiting the dog out, sometimes it's better just to reset the whole search, like start over again, in this case, it's very simple. We're just doing odor recognition. So if the dog is, let's say, paid attention to a distracting odor and it's staying there, instead of waiting the dog out, we just do negative punishment, reset, and start again. And you'll see the dog go, oh, okay, don't do this. Because that was one of the things that Michael taught me was, hey, look, what does waiting the dog out look like? It looks like a duration exercise a lot of times. Mm-hmm. So, and we've all felt it if you've done it long enough. Waiting the dog out on a non-target odor, sometimes those dogs give a better indication on a non-target as we wait them out than they do when it's odor. And that is because when it's odor, one of my friends said, we're like John Wayne. We are on our thing so fast. We whip that toy out. We're so quick with reward. And when it's not, when it's a distracting odor, we're patient. We wait them out. We're willing to, but sometimes that strengthens the behavior before it changes. So we actually have to apply some of the same techniques that we were doing on waiting the dog out, but doing that at odor. But it's also making sure we find what's the right threshold of time for that dog we're working with. That's where the critical part comes into play. And many times we push too far too fast, where it's not solid yet, let's say at 2 seconds, and we've already jumped to 5 seconds, and we have 5 seconds inconsistently, versus going, I have 2 seconds no matter what I do. Now I have 3 seconds no matter what I do. I can try for 5. If I nail 5, I'm going back to 3 seconds again a number of times before I push back to 5. And then that begins to strengthen the behavior, just like you do when you're waiting the dog out on a non-target odor.
Love it. What about the topic? And you went over this about a year ago about odor vessels.
Yes.
Whether it be cotton balls, printer labels, toothpicks. I mean, you talked about the magnetic straws, get scent tubes, TADs. I mean, you went over a lot of things, and there's so much there. And we were limited in time, of course, to go over everything. But again, hitting on the highlights, if someone is hearing this for the first time, what's the most important thing to know about these systems and whatnot?
So odor absorption is a great thing. A lot of us inadvertently used various things for lots of years. Like you said, cotton balls, some have used printer labels, some have used gauze and so forth. But finally, Dr. Nathan Hall did a study because now we had a commercial product that came out, the Get Scent tubes. And that gave us something that had been developed by scientists and chemists that was purposely there to absorb odor. So Nathan and actually Department of Homeland Security wanted to do a research study to say, hey, what is the best and is there something better than what's commercially available? So he started off with the typical thing. Like you said, it was cotton balls It was actually t-shirt material. Oh, wow. I believe the next one was gauze or terry cloth towel kind of concept. And then there was a couple other just unique, weird ones. Could be like metal and wood and so forth. But the Get Sent tube was in there. So the Cliff Notes version is this. The cotton ball gauze pad t-shirt collected or absorbed the most odor. So when you put it under a machine, it was the strongest, but it died out the fastest. It was there and then gone. And depending on the chemical, of course, dictates how long it might last. But those substrates, those materials could absorb an off-gas odor really well, but they would also dissipate really fast. So the Get Scent tube did really good at also absorbing odor, but it emits it out not as, I would say, profoundly or strongly as, let's say, the gauze or the cotton ball did, but it lasted way longer than the cotton ball, t-shirt material, other materials. The Get Scent tube lasted far longer as far as off-gassing the target odor than all the other substances. So the question came down to, okay, well, a Get Scent tube cost me this much. A cotton ball cost me this much. Well, how long am I really putting something out before my dog goes and runs it? So would a cotton ball or t-shirt or gauze material work just as fine as a absorption for odor, you know, as something I can put out? Or did a Get Scent tube make more sense? Now, for those that are looking to train on target materials that they're going to find in the real world, Get Scent tubes are a great thing to have because whether you lose them, whether whatever, it's not a big deal. And you can store them, which is the most important part. The storage of this is where you get lots of reuse out of it. So let's just say you're a person who can't have narcotics. You don't have a DEA license. But you could get some Get Scent tubes. So like obviously they're now being sold that way. But back when I first got them, I could just give them to the drug guys I worked with. They could put them with whatever finds they had, absorb that target material that was there, and then go run the dog later on that. Now, knowing that that odor profile was a much lower level than the actual substance itself because the surface area isn't nearly as big. But my dog, by that time, I had taught it to understand low odor thresholds too. That was another thing that we had learned, that things – just because my dog is trained on a range, let's say 0.2 grams to 40 or 50 grams, didn't mean my dog would be proficient or good at responding to 2 kilos of something, or conversely, something that was 0.002 of something. And additional research was done on that. And what they had learned was not only do the dogs not necessarily understand those thresholds because they get really good at their levels. You know, let's say the average handler has their training kit. And it varies from whatever that range is. Your dog will get really, really good at those levels. But as Paul Bunker and Dr. Nathan Hall discovered, when you went up 10 or down 10, the initial exposure to that, the dogs tested were at, I think it was 6.5% accuracy until reinforced. Right. Once they were reinforced at those newer levels, boom, you were good to go. Back to what, as you probably know, when Dr. Ken Furton talks about currency and drug odor on it, the levels of the drug odor on the currency is so low that handlers aren't even training at those levels, which kind of negates that, oh, your dog is just alerting to money because there's drugs there. No, when a dog does alert to it, it's going to be typically, if it's done properly, the steps done properly, we could then say, yes, the probability is the dog's indicating is because the level of narcotics on this currency is matching the levels that this dog trains at. So it's a really, you know, when you get into these different types of tools to use and then the ripple effect in your training, it goes a lot of different directions. So it's important to understand that these vessels or substrates are great tools to use, but they're not perfect. And you have to understand the pros and cons to using them. And then if it works within all the pros that you want, it has minimal cons, by all means do it. But here's your major caveat. Just make sure whatever you're using as an absorption tool also have a controlled negative of that exact same thing. So if I'm using a Get Scent tube that's been absorbed with narcotics or explosives, I'm also having a Get Scent tube that has nothing on it in my search area. And whether cotton balls, stickers, whatever you're using, always make sure in that same search, you're also having the exact same thing, but with no target odor on it. So you can clearly articulate and demonstrate through your records that the dog is indicating to the one with the target odor on it and not the ones with whatever else.
And that goes with any absorbent or anything you're using, yeah. Correct?
Correct. Everything. I try, as I've gotten older and done this long enough, the hardest work in training detection dogs is the proofing and distraction phase. Yeah. Teaching the target odor, that's the easy thing. The hard part is making sure that my dog is understanding what I want them to alert to, despite any number of proofing things that smell really similar, or it's because, again, I'll use the average police canine handler, your narcotics are in a plastic bag of some sort because they've had to weigh it, label it, and track it, and all that kind of stuff. So my dog, no matter what, when I'm starting a dope dog, is going to go into it in almost all cases when you're using it in this way. That complete odor picture is not just the drugs. It's also those other things, the plastic bag, the canvas bag, whatever you might have to protect the training aid. That's part of that odor profile picture. Yep. And we need to give the dog lots of examples of these other things that are also present, but if there's no target odor present, don't tell me about it. I don't care if canvas is there. I don't care if plastic's there. I only care for you to tell me if the target odor or substance is present. That's what I want you to tell me. So the hardest part is being good stewards about my training to go, okay, if I put this out, what else is part of this? Okay, do we have something that's non-target that's part of this picture? Let's say a bag, and put the bag out. The biggest thing I carry with me now, and I'm doing a lot of LEO stuff, is I have evidence bags with me, the tape, the all that stuff, because those are just such common things that a lot of handlers will have in their drug kit. Or the other thing, Pelican case foam. Taking just Pelican case foam from a Pelican case, not used to store dope, but putting the Pelican case foam out too, because a lot of dogs, when you put that there, because what their dope may be stored in a nice glass jar, but it's in a Pelican case, believe it or not, that contamination of going in and out of your case frequently, you now have a level, and I can't say what it is, but there is and would be a level of contamination of that Pelican case foam. And many of us, especially when you first get those Pelican cases, when you open them up, you can smell it yourself. It's super strong. And I had to learn, this was, again, Dr. Mallory DeChant did a little experiment when she was in Southern California, and we put just Pelican case foam out for dogs that were using Pelican cases, and they were doing overall pretty good storage requirements. Mm-hmm. But when she put that there, man, the dogs were like, that's important. And there's other factors involved, and that's a deeper story. But the main factor was there was a connection for the dog that Pelican case foam odor had relevancy, not to every dog, but a majority of dogs. They were like, ooh. Now, we had a few dogs that went, I recognize that, but I don't smell the other thing. And they moved on. But we had more dogs that generalized and went, yep, that's got to be it. And then they respond. So it's a really, really, really important out of all the things we do in our training of detection dogs is that proofing, distracting stuff to make sure the dog has a good, clear understanding of what that target substance is and the myriad of conditions they might find it in the real world.
Yeah, because to your point, a lot of the times the target odor that we're trying to reach is influenced by the environment around it. And I know Dr. Nathan Hall does a great job of saying and giving those examples of, is the dog picking up on this whole picture? Is it this? Is it that? And the more times we get those exposures, the dog gets that picture a little bit more narrow and a little bit more narrow. So, you know, for me, it's always been, I understand that I can't completely make that training aid as pure as possible. But what I can do is give good exposures to my dog to narrow down exactly what it's looking for.
Yep. And since this will be a video version of the podcast too, I'll insert at this point that video. You probably have seen it before where Nathan sharing the color and shapes and which one should you be paying attention to. He'll show you a photo and say, pay attention to this. And then he shows something else that's got some similarities to it. And everybody's like, oh crap, is that a target or not a target, until he explains it. But and those who haven't seen it, you know, or some have seen it, it's on my YouTube channel, that's its own separate video, but I'll add it to this podcast in the video, so those watching this can go to this and see it.
Perfect. Next topic. You brought his name up before, Michael Ellis. I can tell you he's been a big influence in my career. I feel like I know the guy personally, but he doesn't know who the heck I am. It's just all the videos that I've watched of him, of course. And you kind of fit that description too. It's like, I feel like I know him really well. He just doesn't know I exist. But errorless learning, you did a whole video with Michael Ellis. I know that as handlers and trainers, we want to be perfectionists and we want things to go perfect. But on that topic of errorless learning, kind of explain what that is and why it's important to maybe vary and let your dog fail.
Yeah, so it was a topic actually that was coming up a lot on my travels to Europe when I was doing seminars over there. A number of trainers in the sport detection community also were in some, I won't call them completely force-free. So I have to go back a little bit. As many might know, but there's some that they don't know, in Europe, use of aversive type tools, so such as e-collars, pinch collars, and other choke collar type things, have been banned in various countries. Some have banned all these tools outright. Some have banned only part of them. So that forced the culture over there to look at other means of training. And force-free type of training has tons of traction. And there's a lot of truth to where you can, what things you can do. But errorless learning is a component in there that comes up frequently in those same circles. And what that particularly focuses on is setting up basically a super simple context of training where the dog doesn't make an error. It's so easy that reinforcement keeps happening. And even if, let's say, and I'm probably not doing it the best justice and explanation, but you're setting this up so there's almost no way for the dog to make a mistake, so therefore you're able to keep rewarding. And even if they're not exactly doing the thing, you can still reinforce it to keep them going. So it's like taking the term is splitting. They split things down to such a small, easy step that you can accomplish it and get a reward. And then you add another really simple step and they can accomplish that. But like anything else, and that was the point that Michael made in the video, we talked about it, is learning an error and the consequence of the error. And the consequence can be a ton of different things. It could just be not getting what you want. It could be, you know, nature creates its own aversions. If a dog sticks its nose into where a beehive is at, a hole in the ground, it happens to be an area where a wasp is at, I promise you the next time they'll smell that the wasp, they're going to kind of avoid that area. So nature has a certain way of teaching, even within the species themselves. There are forms of a level of aversive, whatever it is, from a growl to a posture to, like I said, the environment doing something, that errors happen and those consequences form good learning. And everything, there's consequences. Now, I can understand and appreciate the conversations and the feelings from those who want to reduce that as much as possible. I'm all for good well-being of the animals and good mental well-being. But I also understand it's important to have some boundaries or something that teaches a dog, this is not so good, but this is really good. So I like being on the side of creating a situation where my dog does something that's correct or desired. There's lavish reinforcement for that. And then something that's undesired or purposely, let's say, towards a level of aggression or activation, there has to be or can be some type of, I don't know what, it all depends. That's why I can't be specific, but some type of aversion. Could be just simply putting them away. Could be something that's taking away something they wanted. A number of different things, but there that errorless learning isn't as real as many would want it to be. And I'm not saying you can't do it, because there's plenty of people that will show you that they can. There's truths to both sides. And that's another thing that Michael has shared when it comes to the different arguments in the dog world. Both sides have their truths. There's people that will show you they have a force, they have a dog that trained force-free. Can they train every dog force-free? Well, we know the answer is probably no. There's going to be someone. Can I train a dog only on compulsion? Sure. Somebody can train a dog completely by compulsion. Is it the type of dog that some people would want to work? Probably not. Mm. So both sides have truths to them, we have to be much better these days. And this is one of the lessons I've learned a lot, especially about around being Mayor Michael, was being understanding of the other point of view, even though it may not be what I support or completely believe, but I have to take and understand that their point of view may not be completely wrong either. And their experiences up to this point have fed them that knowledge that says, this is why I believe what I believe, just like it has been for me. So I am much better about listening now and respecting that that's their point of view. And I want to hear from them. I want them also, whenever possible, show me how that, whatever that thing is, show me how it worked and repeat it for me besides just this one animal that you're working with. Do it with me with something else too, just so it's not that one hit wonder kind of thing. Oh, it works. And my experience is one dog or maybe only a couple dogs. And that's where a lot of where the rubber meets the road with no matter whose argument it is in our dog world, the results speak for themselves the most more than our opinions. So that's where now I spend a lot of time I'd rather show you and then give you numerous dog examples of that.
And so two things could be true at the same time, right? And anecdotal evidence is still evidence, right? And some people will utilize that, those experiences. We can't just completely ignore people's experience. That's how we learn, right? Through experience. I got to give props to you about something that I don't know if you remember you did for me. I don't know the year it happened. I want to say 2020, maybe. You and I had discussions about, we're kind of dating ourselves. We're like Skyped at that time, I think, right? No one Skypes anymore.
Yeah.
But I was teaching a handler course and we were doing some detection stuff. And I was like, hey, I want you guys to listen to a different voice on detection, even though we're doing it different here. Cameron does it different. And I want you to listen to how he approaches odor and detection. And I really appreciate that because it gave guys other resources and skill sets. And it challenged me like, you know what, that makes a lot of sense. I want those tools in my chest. So if we get to the point where just because something or somebody else does it different, we lose opportunities to learn from each other, because I've learned so much since then from other trainers all over the world. And thank God for the internet, as much as it could be a bad thing, but it absolutely can be a good thing if utilized the right way. So I never got to formally say thanks for that, but just some inside. I mean, that's really cool that you did that.
No, and you're right. I mean, there's so much to be learned by others. And I don't have to agree with every little thing that they do. Mm-hmm. I can totally appreciate their perspective, and maybe their experiences have shown them whatever it is that they're doing works. And I want to know why. And now that I have a much better, it's our culture, I would say, in the, let's just say, the law enforcement military community has a lot about, it's institutionalized with rank and position and there's a lot of things that bolster, you have to prove yourself or you have to prove whatever you're doing works. That's how you get followers in a sense, as far as following your leadership. But what I've really learned is, especially after some of my time with Naval Special Warfare and then now being around somebody like Michael, it's what's really important is sitting back and taking in whatever you're watching somebody do. And is there something that they can show you or offer you that makes you better? And it doesn't have to be in line with all of your personal beliefs. You don't have to buy into all of the things that they do. But you can absolutely, if you're willing to sit back and close your mouth and listen and watch, wow, there's that thing right there that resonated with me. I'm definitely putting that in my toolbox, or I want to play with it some and figure out how well I can do it. So that way, if I ever need that thing or that technique, I have it available to me because I understood it. I didn't shut them down because of they followed a certain methodology that I just didn't align with, but I can actually learn from them. And that's really something I've grown a lot myself on, because again, I came from the same culture a lot of us did, and it was all about this is the way. And then I realized, wow, one of the top tier programs in the world embraces differences and really wants to understand why. And if someone's got something, they're going to listen to it. and take what they can, because if they can take that one piece and insert it into their program and it enhances what they do, it's a win. And I don't, and they don't have to, which is why there's cops in the tier one special forces community as instructors, because there's a piece in the law enforcement community and the experience that comes into play that that special operations program goes, that person or that side's knowledge and experience can be useful for what we need to do. So let's bring them in and get there. That's the only reason why I had the job I had, was because the guy who I worked for, Jeff Franklin, had the, he was already in. Yep. And what that program understood was, hey, cop dog handlers have experience deploying dogs in lots of different conditions. We don't. We only get to deploy dogs in really certain niche conditions. And back then it was the Wild West and no one really knew which way to go. But they, but as the programs evolved, they realized, okay, let's pull in some people who have actual experience in deploying dogs in really odd environments, and what can they provide? And that was also something I had to learn, which is important when you do cross-pollinate, is staying in your lane, staying in the specialty that you do, provide that information. And even though you might know some stuff about the other things that they do, you're, you just stay to what you know. And that's, again, easier said than done. Sometimes the excitement, I got crushed one time because I came in there saying something. I was like, oh, well, it was because of this. And the look I got from one of the other Navy SEAL instructors, if I would have been killed if there was, you know, one of, in fact, the other Navy SEAL guy with me was like, I'm just go hang out by the car for a little while and I'll get back with you. And I learned that's where I was like, just shut the hell up. Let them do what they do. That's their operate, like actual movement into a structure, out of a structure. That's their job. The dog part, I was just say, this is a good idea for the dog. And if the dog can't do it, I'll try to help you train it. That was what I had to do. But so when this is where, like, there's a lot of conversations that happen in the dog world about, or the cop world, about civilians helping out police officers. I have feelings about that too. I think there's a ton of really good information that cops can obtain from being around some good civilian trainers and take those things. The civilian trainers, by all means, help the cops. If you haven't had experience in taking down suspects or deploying in certain types of calls, don't cross that line and give them advice of how to work their dog in that type of condition. Give them the advice of how to just be a good handler with that dog. Let the cop stuff stay the cop stuff. And that's where, as we both know, where the cop world kind of, our hairs kind of go up, is when there's that civilian dog trainer saying, okay, this is how you hold on a door, and this is what you need to do before you make entry, or this is how I'd push the dog. That's not our lane. Yep. All right, when if you're in that position, your lane is to say, okay, do you want the dog to be in a down right here? Do you want the dog quiet? Do you want the dog to bark? What do you want the dog to do? That's what I'm here to help you work with. How you guys do all that other stuff, make entry, clear rooms, that's your thing. I'm just there to make sure the dog does its thing or help you understand what the dog's doing. And if we stay in those lanes, then there's so much good that can happen from both sides. Both sides benefit tremendously.
I think it also gives us an opportunity to collaborate with others who are doing things at a high level, right? I'm lucky enough that when we do a workshop here, usually once a year, you know, Will Chesney will come down. He's a SEAL team member on SEAL Team 6, working a dog. And we do integration into SWAT. And the first thing I say is, I'm not a SWAT guy, but I have a friend. And, you know, we'll completely take over those exercises. And we are all there to learn from a guy who did it at the highest levels. It's no different than doing a workshop with Carlos Ramirez. Yeah, I can get in a bite suit, but why would I be the one to get in a bite suit if you have him there, right? Like, he's the subject matter expert. He's the guy that you're going to get so much out of it. And it just gives us opportunities to collaborate with others.
Oh, for sure. I mean, and you could, if you don't already know, you could ask Will. Most of the trainers in Damneck, where he's from, are Virginia Beach PD or Norfolk PD canine officers. That's why they're there, because of the experience that they had. And those guys, I mean, I've been there. Those guys will tell you, hey, look, we are here to do the dog stuff. They're operators. They're going to do the operator stuff. And when you're there for a lot of years, you pick up. I mean, I was in the program I was in for 4 years. in after the first, you know, into the second year, you've got a pretty good grasp of how procedurally they do things. They call their TTPs. Mm-hmm. You get it. You understand it. And yeah, it's one of those things where little knowledge is dangerous. You could do enough to kind of say, okay, this is okay. Get ready to do the barrel wave of the doorway, clear, you know, that kind of stuff. But that's not your thing. And it's, and again, I, with lack of a better term, I've stepped on my dick enough times where I was like, shit, damn it.
Cameron Ford swears.
Yeah. Sometimes my classes get a little crazy, but yeah, I've definitely learned to, as hard as it was, you know, sometimes it's just, you want to validate yourself. You want to show that you know something. So you jump in. That's a lot of times why I did what I did. I jumped in because I was like, ooh, see, I know it. I know how to do it. And it wasn't the right moment, the right time, or the need to do it. And most times it made me look not the way I wanted to. It didn't come off the way I had hoped because, you know, the alternative motive, the ulterior motive wasn't what it should have been. The motive was, should have been, I'm here to help you get better with your dog, and I'm here to help the dog perform whatever the task is. I'm not here to show you what I know as far as being a cop or an operator at those times when we were doing those things. So yeah, that's kind of the thing I always try to, you know, as our world gets smaller with social media and the advent of ways to market and then also understanding our industry. So many handlers just want to get better. And they're with a small agency, or there just isn't the resources in their region for them. So they have no choice but to look in any direction where somebody will support them. Just kind of like you said, you know, I was super appreciative that you guys reached out to me to be on that Skype and just talk about what you guys were doing that day and some of the things that I share. And shit, man, even since then, I've evolved a number of different ways from that point in time. I even this class we're doing right now, some of the videos we were sharing in one of our lectures, I was like, crap, we got to remove that video because we don't even do that anymore. So, and that's, you know, I have to look back. And that's a good thing that if you can look back and you can say you keep making little incremental changes and improvements and willingness to try things and a lot of things and some of these things that you're going to do, you're going to take from a resource that may not be from your community or industry. You're going to look at something and go, oh, wow. I mean, that's for me, totally. It's how the little odor pays box thing all came about was two things happened. I had seen the, what's his name? Dick Stahl. I seen Dick Stahl's videos with using the article in the box. Then, so that was the first time I seen something like that. Then Bart was doing something similar, but slightly different, but same concept. Right. Box, something in it. They stay there despite things happening. And then the science world came in and they were talking about delayed conditioning. And then in that same time frame was when Michael Ellis was really growing with the use of markers and a lot of other stuff. And then the last little ingredient that I personally needed was I was actually dating a SeaWorld trainer at the time. And she was questioning me on why I was doing things the way I was doing it. And lo and behold, the first step was I started understanding condition reinforcer markers. And then I took that box concept and I said, well, they're doing it with an article. Why don't I just do it with odor? And that was literally how it started. And then seeing the science side doing something very similar, but just with a pipe instead of or like a port instead of a box. But the dog had to go to the port first, intake, you know, smell in there, and then reinforcement happened. I was like, if I can do this with something that's very repeatable by a lot of other, you know, let's say the average cop or the average military person or whoever, this is something that can be easily taught and done again by somebody else. And that's literally how that happened. I had another cop who I happen to know, a guy named Chaz. He made the very first prototype boxes that I had with the HDPE plastic. Then we put a little insert in it that could hold the can, because the first versions I ever did was just take a normal dopamine box that was out there and I put the can in it. Lessons I learned was, oh crap, the dog will start moving the can around. So that's not going to be as good. Okay, I need to stabilize the can. How can I do that? Oh, let's put an insert in that holds the can. Boom. Now we had that. Then we could drop food into it if we wanted to do that, and the dog would hold position. I can just keep dropping just like Dick and just like Bart does. And then I can start, you know, proofing my dog's behavior. Now keep doing this behavior despite no reinforcement happening, and also despite the stuff I do. And then that's just kind of happened. Then later on, there's a Dutch guy who makes these boxes, says, hey, I can do that all by computer. It's a lot cheaper. And of course, the cop I had helping out, he was like, dude, I'm getting inundated with orders. I'm a full-time cop. You could stop sharing the video with my white box on there because I can't keep up with the people wanting it. So that all of that stemmed from me just watching other people do something and then me going, ooh, I like that. How can I put that here? And a couple other conditions happening at the same time, me personally, that I was learning that it all made sense. And that was just because I was staying open-minded and willing to work and watch what others were doing.
I love it, man. You mentioned Michael Ellis a bunch in this conversation. We all have people that we learn from. We all have mentors. It's no secret that Tony Guzman has been a huge influence in my career and has given me an opportunity in so many different ways. And he continues to be that for me. Who are some of your mentors? This is an opportunity for you to give them credit, of course, and shout their praises and go through the list of people. Cause sometimes it's not, you know, I say Tony Guzman, but it's a list of guys I can go. And if I do, I'll miss somebody and then I'll feel bad about it. So I'll stop there, but, give us that list to the best of your memory and how they impacted your career.
For sure. The very first one was a guy named Bob Gailey. Bob Gailey was the first, he kind of started police dogs in Florida. I can't say for a fact that he was the first guy, but he was, if not the first, probably the second. And this was in the early 70s. He had just got out of the army. He was a sentry dog handler. And this is a name that you're going to recognize. He went to the very first Pat Cahill school in Washington, D.C. So when Pat Cahill, those who don't know who Pat Cahill is, he was a British cop that came to the United States and was the first one to show that dogs could be used in a non-sentry dog kind of way. And what that meant was the dog could actually be social enough, but not be just only so aggressive it could only be handled by one person. It was finally a dog that could be handled, be in a social situation, and not want to kill everything. So Bob had been an Army sentry dog handler. He happened to be stationed in D.C. The Army was looking at how do we create a military working dog that's not a sentry dog and sent him and other Army members to the school with Pat Cahill in D.C. He then gets out of the Army, starts police dogs in Florida. That was my neighbor. So as a little kid, that was who it impacted me. All these dogs, when I was like really young, I was scared of. I became his little demo kid that he would put in the back of a station wagon to show that this vicious Rottweiler wouldn't eat me and German Shepherds that he had weren't going to kill me. And his dogs were social, that kind of stuff. So he was my first one, and he was how it all started for me. I mean, how they brought me in, I was just like with the old school stuff. I cleaned kennels for like a year, and then an entire year of a police canine class. I sat on a bench outside. That's all they would let me do. I sat there for an entire year and did nothing but watch them work their dogs. Then finally the next year happened and the class started, and one of Bob's really good friends and trainers, another guy who was another big influence on me, was Michael Ansley. Mike was a cop in the city of Sanford, Florida, and this was back in the day. Sanford's known now from a lot of the Trayvon Martin case and stuff like that. But it was my neighboring agency when I became a cop later on. I was in the city of Lake Mary. Sanford was a neighboring agency. But anyway, Mike was a guy that came up to me and tossed the sleeve down at my feet and goes, okay, you're done watching. Go imitate what you've seen us do as decoys and go do this. And from that point on, I was decoying, laying tracks, hiding in cabinets in schools. I mean, just for another solid year doing that. So those guys put me through those paces. After that, I'd say Bob Gailey, Mike Ansley, then one of my best friends, Matt Gibbs. He was a fellow. He was a handler at a city that I ended up working at later on. We were good friends, but at the time when he first and I met, I was a vendor and I was selling dogs in Florida. He was a cop at the agency. We became fast friends because I ended up picking out one of the dogs that was his personal dog later on. But he was one of those guys that loved to tinker with training stuff. He was a Tennessee country boy, didn't necessarily prescribe to any of these dog training models or methods. He was like, I don't give a shit what you call it. I just call it working with my dog or doing this. And we'd have these great debates at night and we would tinker with dogs. We would get done, like training would be from like 4 p.m. to 4 a.m. and he and I and maybe a couple other guys would still be there at 8 a.m. as sunlight's up now. We're like, oh, we should probably go to bed now. Because after training was done, we couldn't help ourselves but tinker. But the tinkering and challenging each other's perspectives was the next thing that had a big influence on me. After that, I would say the people like Bob Bailey, who I finally got to meet a year ago, but reading some things about him or vicariously hearing about him through other friends of mine, like Simon Prinz and other ones, were substantial in having effect. And I can't not mention that the SeaWorld trainer that really helped me understand communication with an animal better than I thought. And then outside of that, then as the years went on, I mean, I was lucky. I was stationed in Germany during my military time, and I got to be around. So there's a story I've shared before, but at one point in time, I was at a farm field in Germany, and it was Dr. Helmut Reiser and Bart Balan teaching together.
Crazy.
And there were maybe 25, 30 of us. Me and one other army handler I was Air Force, he was Army, but we were friends. He came over and the two of us sat there, and the seminar was in German mostly. And so I had been in Germany enough years, I could sit and listen and understand a lot of things, but I couldn't speak it great. But that seminar had a profound effect because Bart at that time was still just kind of starting his e-collar life and career. He was, you know, he wasn't what he is now. He was like anybody else when they first start off. So there was this one dog in particular that was kind of giving him some struggles that he was trying to do with a collar, but the dog just wasn't responding to it. And then there was some handler stuff that was causing some problems. Helmut comes in and goes and said this phrase, conflict on purpose and conflict on accident. Conflict on purpose we create so the dog learns something. Conflict by accident is something that we do that causes a dog to make an error, but it's caused by us. So the example that he gave specifically at that point in time was the handler tells the dog to sit and stay next to them, but then they kick the sleeve out to the decoy to go pick up. The dog breaks. He says, if a dog hasn't understood that yet and you correct the dog, you punish the dog, that was conflict on accident. You by accident caused a dog to break because the dog wasn't there yet. Now, later on, if you taught the dog the position, the dog knew it well, you'd start off by maybe picking the sleeve up, putting it down before you go kicking it out. So he was showing, on purpose, I'm teaching. By accident, there's errors that happen, and sometimes dogs unfairly, and I never forgot that. So he was another one. And then just being friends with other trainers throughout my career, you know, Ivan and I have known each other for a lot of years. I just got to see him again probably about 3 months ago in IACP. Mm-hmm. And he's had lots of influence on me in the sense of making me look at things differently. He's kind of, I joke around, and Michael says the same thing about him. He's a savant. He looks at dogs in ways that you just don't even think of. And you're like, holy cow. And that, just throwing stuff at him, like I told him a story on the stage and we were speaking, he forgot about telling me the story. And I was like, see that, I remember that. And then the last one I'll mention that still is somebody who I look forward to besides Michael Ellis. That's, I think people know that one well, but Dr. Stuart Hilliard, he's at Lackland. He's been there a number of years, but he is a encyclopedia / dog genius. The natural skills he has in just reading dogs is amazing. The history behind him. So he won't admit it, and he's not 100% sure, but I'm pretty sure he's the first one that brought a Malinois from Europe to the United States. Wow. There was a dog named UFO. not UFO. It was a different dog, but then he had UFO after that, or UFO, whatever it was called. But anyway, he was one of the first. So the history behind him, we're starting to pull him back out of the dark, you know, being hidden in the military world, to come back out into the world, to, because there's so many generations of trainers that don't know of him. And those who've been around long enough remember those VHS tapes under CTS, Canine Training Systems. He was the producer and director, and he was the one that wrote Ivan's first videos for him.
Wow.
Like wrote out the plan, the storyboard, and all that kind of stuff. So you ever just want to have a deep conversation and go in the weeds, Doc is one of those guys. Stuart is, you know, he even makes Michael sometimes second guess things that he thought he knew about dog training, And then he's sitting around Doc, and then it turns into like, wait, I now question classical conditioning now. I don't even know if I truly know it. So yeah, those would be my top list of people. There's, like you said, there's lots more that have affected me or that I've paid attention to. You know, like I said, I still throw Bart in the equation, because Bart and Dick Stahl, because I've taken things from these individuals and I've learned from them. Kenny Licklider, I've taken things I've learned from him. He's absolutely been an influence in how I applied the detection phase from what I joke around as canine 1.0, where it was scratch alert, to where it became passive alert. And I had all the guys who I grew up with and learned from saying, oh, passive alert dogs can't pinpoint. My scratch alert dog will scratch right where dope's at, but passive alert dogs can't do that. And then being around Kenny, I was like, wow, okay, he showed me a new way. Yep. And that obviously had an effect. And his reach is huge because of his business and kennels. And I have an enormous amount of respect for him for what he's done. Do we have to agree on all our training philosophies? Absolutely not. You know, I expect, yeah, those that know him, expect people like him who have done stuff for a long time to also challenge you. And I always embrace those challenges. He's had some good stuff with me. But then the funny part is, the dog world's a dog world. People automatically assume that you have to hate each other just because you don't necessarily agree, and don't even know that I would look at him and say he's had an impact on me. Him, all those guys. I'd even say I throw Randy Hare into the mix, because when I make my, I have a little image that I use. I show Canine 1.0, which is scratch alert. Canine 2.0 is where Kenny comes in and shows the world that passive alerts can be done, and it can be done this way, and it works. And then I say Randy Hare took the needle to what I call 2.5, which showed that you didn't have to do the magic show with rewards. Rewards can be visible and all over the place, and your dog could understand. The only thing that he didn't add, that's where we're at now, where I call 3.0, is where the use of a condition reinforcer comes into play. So if you just added a condition reinforcer to what Randy Hare was doing, that's 3.0 right there. So, but all of those guys have had an impact on me and my learning. And though I don't have to agree, or they don't have to agree with some of the things, I highly respect every single one of those names there, because they've all played a role in my development.
Well, that's awesome. I love giving credit to the people, you know, who deserve it, because like we said before, we didn't come out the womb understanding this information. We were all taught this information. Yeah. It all came from somewhere. And, it's just nice to be able to give credit where credit's due. And anytime I get an opportunity to, you know, highlight the mentors that have been a part of my life, I try to do that, because I think it's good practice. And, you know, one day someone will do it for you, I'm sure, and you'll be on that list of a mentor for them. And absolutely, absolutely. So we have to switch gears a little bit. So that was more of a serious thing, less of a serious thing. Yeah. Give me a second. I have a prop for you. I can do this with a prop on. Hold on.
Okay.
Okay.
This is awesome.
So I want to talk to you about pseudo versus real.
So those, if you're not watching this, he has a rainbow clown hat or hair on, and a bright red nose on his face.
Looks good.
To represent the misinformed odor clown that I am, unfortunately.
So let's talk about it, man.
Yes. So, man, I was, you know, gosh, what years was it? Let's just say 2009, 6, somewhere around there. I'm going to say 2009, 10-ish. Is where I first got my hands on some synthetic training aids, some pseudos. And that was, I was like, this is awesome. This is really helping me do some training. And I was starting to, that was my first foray getting deeper into understanding science or why certain things were the way they were. And in this case, David Adebimbe would go around and do seminars. And I would be one of the few people that would stick around and stay in those seminars. You know, I remember one of the very first ones he did at the Canine Cop Conference in Tennessee. I don't know if it was his very first one, but it was one of the very early ones. At the first break, dude, there were like so many people left the room. And it literally went from, like, I don't know the number, let's just say 40 people down to 10 of us. that were really interested, because David went so deep that most of the people just didn't even understand it anymore. I barely understood it. I understood maybe 10%, but I was energized to go, well, there's something here to this. I want to understand it more. So I got into it. I was probably one of the disciple people, that they call it now, that was, you know, pseudo was the way to go. I wholeheartedly believed it, but I didn't. All I had at that time was David telling me or showing me the information he had. In 2000, gosh, 16, no, later than that. I'm just going to say 18-ish, 2018-ish, is where I meet Dr. Nathan Hall, Lauren DeGrief, Paola Tiedemann, and the other scientists in the detection dog community. They posed challenging questions to me based on the beliefs that I had. And one of the first questions that was asked was, okay, if you currently believe that that synthetic material that you're using, and you can put it whatever you want, it doesn't have to be any certain brand, but whatever brand you align with or you like or you purchase, you train your dog on this. Now, will that transition in a blind lineup, will your dog generalize to the real? Because that's the true, that's one of the tests that you could, especially if the common line of a, in this case, the manufacturer is saying the dog is the one that matters. Doesn't matter what a computer test says. It doesn't matter. The dog's nose matters. Okay, I'll follow that. And according to, till I learned this, they said, okay, if the dog's nose matters, you train the dog on the synthetic, then we should be able to put up a lineup in front of you. It's blind to you. Three lineups. One will have zero target odor or synthetic in it. Another lineup would have synthetic, and another lineup would have target in it. If the synthetic really has the dog understand target, the dog should, at a minimum, at least acknowledge the real substance in the lineup. And you should be able to see this yourself. That didn't work. That didn't happen. And I was like, and internally I was like, oh crap. I've never looked at it that way. And like Nathan pointed out to me, why do you believe it worked? And I said, well, because I've trained dogs on it and I've gone to real and they've done fine. He said, okay, when you went to real, what did you do? I said, oh, it was a pretty simple search problem. I put the real out, you know, and when my dog showed change, he said, okay. Let me ask you, was your dog acknowledging the fact that that was odor there, or was it the only thing that didn't belong there? Was it the novel thing or the strong salient thing? And I was like, oh, I don't know. And he's like, and what did you do with the dogs that weren't quite as good with it? Well, of course, you help them out. You present again, or you do whatever the thing is that you do. And he goes, so could you agree that your dog knows the synthetic odor, and then you also ended up training the dog on the real odor too? And that maybe the two didn't make the connection. And I was like, okay. He goes, so you have to look at it with a critical eye. And like anything in the research world, you're learning this now. You want independent reviews and other ways of testing or looking at whatever you profess. Mm-hmm. So let's look at this isn't the really the best example, but it's the easiest one I can give to people to understand. When a new drug hits the market. So let's use Viagra as the one that everybody can relate to. When Viagra came on the market, the manufacturer has the patent to it. You cannot make a generic version of Viagra until a certain time goes by. But once you make a generic version of Viagra, what does that generic version have to do? It has to pass all FDA testing, make sure it is what it says it is, and it can do the thing that it says it does. We don't have a mechanism like that for us in the world where synthetics say they can do what they say they do. And does the synthetic – so there's been additional testing. There's research out by Department of Homeland Security where they looked at different manufacturers of synthetics, compared it to the real substances, and gave findings that way. And each manufacturer – and I'm not going to quote each one because I don't have it in front of me – but – each manufacturer had significant deficiencies, or, and I say deficiencies, meaning either they were not close to the chemical at all, which was believed to be tested, or had some chemicals, but there are so many or a much stronger other chemical that overshadows the other one. Now, the argument that's made by some of the manufacturers is, well, that's because you're looking at it from the chemist point of view. You're not looking at it to the dog point of view. And that's why I circle back to Nathan's statement. Okay, if I take the dog's point of view, I should be able to do that. So Randy Hare, as we all know, did a version of this, not exactly like what Nathan explained, but a Randy's version. And of course, found the anomaly that he saw. David is one that will bring that one. That's one of the research that I won't call it research. That's one of the tests that he'll bring up as, well, it's the hair anomaly. Randy was the only one that had this anomaly occur. And that, so what I share frequently is right now, I mean, every chemist I've talked to says there is a world that we'll have where synthetics can play a role. Mm-hmm. Are we there yet? Not exactly. Certain things can be synthesized better than other things. For example, synthetic things, you know, chemical-based things are easier to synthesize than organic things in some cases. So where we're at right now is there's not necessarily enough proof to substantiate claims made by manufacturers that equal, you know, like, but what happens is you have a community of dog handlers who are just like me, who will say, I believe it works because this is what I did. What I can now bring up is it that the synthetic worked, or is it that you trained your odor when you had your access to Real? Did you just end up training the dog on Real just like you trained on synthetic? And synthetic in this case is played a really good role in at least teaching dog detection skills. It taught the dog how to hunt for a target odor, what to do when it found it, how to deal with it, how the environment affects it, and all these things. And then when you ended up adding Real substance, whatever it was, your dog had an understanding, and therefore your dog knows all the synthetics and all the Reals. So the library, the database of that dog's head is bigger. So that's where – so I made a video basically stating all of the things I just stated right there, and – along with some satire there, I make fun of our own community going, we don't believe hardly anybody. But then all of a sudden when somebody with a PhD comes in and says this works, we automatically believe it without any true testing. But our nature in law enforcement is to have some suspicion and want some type of factual validation to something. And in this area, we're not as diligent as we are with other things when it comes to that. So I just shared that it's important for us to have that scientific eye to say, okay, if this works, then I should be able to, if I train my dog on synthetic substance, do a lineup unknown to me and should, and then like I said, there has to be options of a blank, the target you've trained on, the synthetic, and then the target you believe synthetic will connect to, and you don't know where those are at. Those are set up blindly. And if it does, then that dog made the generalization and the connection and thanks to that substance that happened. So that's where that became controversial because, I guess not a lot of people had said it in that right. way. And I know David, those who know David's a very passionate mm-hmm. person, very passionate person. And when something gets his attention, he will put full effort into a conversation about that, good or bad. I've learned a lot from him. He's opened my perspective up. The only thing I do not personally like that he does is when he takes it to outside the learning model and goes into personal attacks and goes into, and that's not just me. I mean, he can attack me personally if he wants to. It's not going to hurt my feelings, but I've seen that behavior done to other people without merit.
Yeah.
And that's where the professional part changes for me. And I'm like, David, I have no problem engaging in conversation, but we got to do it without it flipping into a personal attack or like the misinformed odor clown comment or glorified researchers that with people with PhDs, they're nothing but a glorified researcher. We can engage in conversation without it going that direction, and we can either agree or just as the old saying goes, agree to disagree and let things just go out that way.
And the beautiful things about Facebook is that you have people can stand behind a keyboard and talk and argue about these things in full transparency. I've had these conversations with David in person. They will always be in person. I told him I'll never have these conversations online because holy cow, can it go left and be misunderstood? And then you're part of a camp. You're either part of this camp or that camp. And I just don't believe in that division. I don't think it's good for our industry. I think that guys like David and his product will probably have a purpose in our industry. Yeah. But we have to be careful and we have to be real about these things. And as he says, practitioners have a responsibility. And part of that responsibility is to question when there's a product that comes out and anything that is being stated that product can do. And without scientific validation from a third party, which I don't think there is that I know of, it's very difficult to either say yes or no. A lot of anecdotal evidence is out there. Him and I are constantly in debate in person when we go to these places where we're both instructing. I find it very funny. I enjoy it. We laugh about it. I give him a hug afterwards. And as we say, we can agree to disagree. And I'll kind of leave it at that. But I appreciate you being able to speak on something that got a little heated, a little personal at one point. But I think it's good for the industry to understand that that these things can be talked about in constructive ways, and we can learn from each other, regardless of where you fall on what camp.
For sure, and you know, like I said, it didn't. I wasn't mad at, as you got to see. I mean, I turned the whole misinformed odor clown into a big joke, and that was mainly just to steal the thunder from the emotion that he was pulling into it that didn't need to be there. Like you said, let's have a factual conversation, which is hard to do not in person, because just like you said, the biggest issue with social media is the misunderstanding of textual feelings, if that makes sense, right? So I have to read a text, and then behind this text, can I understand what that intent or feeling or emotion is? And we get that wrong so frequently. I can tell you right now, I'm not the best communicator. Sometimes in my messages or a post, in my head, it sounds like this. And then when it's written and I post it, and then I look at it later, or someone says, what did you mean by this? I'm like, oh, crap. That's one of those ones I didn't read before I send it kind of thing. I'm also, you know, because I'm a passionate instructor and I get into the moment sometimes. I did it here. It was funny. They were making fun of me. I have 25 years and more of military law enforcement type instruction. So I speak loud. I'm quick. I'm, you know, sometimes get your head out of your ass. Come on, come on, let's do it. You know, and sometimes I do things with intent on purpose to shake the tree a little bit to get somebody either out of the fog or stress them.
Yep.
But I also have learned how to be better about communicating so that way it doesn't come off wrong. And circling back to this point too that we just talked about, one of the things I got to learn, you know, later on. So when I challenged us as an industry about detection in certain ways, when I would push to say, why are we doing it this way? I forgot to look at it from the perspective of our defensive side of ourselves, where when someone calls out an error on us, we're probably in most cases, whether it's cop or not, we're naturally going to just become defensive about it, you know, because why are you calling me out on this? Well, you know, this doesn't feel good. And, you know, I went through the phase of, you know, my goal was to make us better. So I wanted to call out those errors and say, let's address them. Let's get after it. Let's fix it. But what I ended up learning was there were certain segments, and it was usually the generation that was older than me would take that as an attack on them. And that was because they didn't have the information that I have now. So when I proposed things to them, certain people were going to take offense, and I failed to read that. I failed to understand that that's what was going to happen, where I internally was going, oh, if I show them this, here's this, and here's how we can be better, they would automatically follow it because it makes common sense. But no, when I automatically, or when I did something, they automatically went into defense. They stopped listening to me at that point. There was no more conversation going to happen because they're now in a position to defend what they believed or try to understand what I was talking about, even though they may not. And that's not comfortable either. So, you know, there was a story a friend of mine told me, you know, I had done a lot of stuff with the NPCA and spoke a few things. And then one of my friends later on, he does some stuff with Terry Anderson. And he goes, Harry, he's like, oh yeah, Terry knows you. Terry said, Cameron's a good guy, knows a lot of stuff, but he's too damn hard on those cops. And I was like, why did he, I go, what did he say? He goes, oh, just, you know, at your lectures, you were calling them out too much. And, you know, and I looked at it and I was like, man, he's right. And then I had a conversation with Michael Ellis one time about it too. And I was like, and actually Bob Bailey was another one where I did a lecture and he said to me, after I got done, I said, Bob, I'd really love to hear your point of view. Like, how can it be better? You know, you're one of the best at this. He goes, forgiveness, Cameron. The first thing I would tell you is forgiveness. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, what? Forgiveness? What do you mean? Like, how is that relevant to, I'm thinking like, am I teaching the material right or whatever? He goes, you need to forgive your industry because yes, we know we are flawed. We have our flaws and there's a desire and need to be better. He goes, but when you highlight those issues, sometimes he's like, there's a time, his words were exactly, there's the time to be the first sergeant and there's the time to be the coach. Mm-hmm. And he goes, where they're at right now, more coaching is better than being the first sergeant. And that moment I changed. And then Michael helped me get even better because I was asking him, I'm like, how do you do it? How do you work? I mean, first, you're the opposite of what most cops think of as a trainer. You're the law. You got the ponytail, the hippie kind of personality. You're the happy guy. But man, you have impacted so many people in the law enforcement community. I said, how do you deal with that internal struggle of, you know, what they're doing is actually harder or worse on their dog, but they don't understand or they can't grasp what you're trying to teach them? He goes, I have to be patient. I have to let them find their way because yes, I could tell them certain things, but if they have no point of reference where to put it, I haven't done anything but confuse them further. And I was like, he goes, so just carefully give out information. And then those who are ready to learn more will seek you out to learn more and start investing your time in them. And then that will help it grow more and more and more. But if you come at them with, hey, here, guys, here's the problem. And I also have the solution over here. Sometimes by highlighting the problem, shut down their reception to hearing what the solution was. So that's where one of the things over the past 2 years, I have really tried to, I have shifted a lot of my lectures now to be much more interactive between me and the group because I need to hear where their thoughts are at, where they are at when they're looking at something. So therefore, I can then be better about, here's information that might be relevant that you can digest at this point versus wanting to share with you everything and you only get 10% of it anyway. So I'd rather give you the 10% and then focus on that 10%. And then when you're ready, give you 10 more and so forth. So, yeah.
So speaking of humans learning differently, right? And receiving information differently, it's a perfect segue to the cognition, the canine cognition stuff you do. And I know we're kind of running low on time. So I want to hit this point and then I want to hit you with some, just like some rapid questions and then we'll tie a bow on it. So, canine cognition, I think it's so important what you're doing and the research that you're doing there. And I know it's not something that you necessarily created, but you've really taken it and made it your own. Really explain to people what that is and in a nutshell. Go ahead, take it.
Okay. So it's those who don't know the story, I give it a little bit in my lectures, but so when I was with Naval Special Warfare, it was one of these times I was not working. I was at home watching TV and it was Nat Geo Wild that was on. And there was a TV show called Is Your Dog a Genius? And I was like, what is this? So I'm watching it. This Dr. Brian Hare, who's the professor at Duke University, who really kind of brought cognition, canine cognition to more of a mainstream. He was showing these games, which were tests that he was running with dogs. What I saw was, holy cow, this highlights how much the dog is using me for information. And this is really big in detection. So my initial look at it was like, these tests can maybe help me be a better detection dog handler if my dog's paying too much attention to me. Episode ended. I Googled his name. I looked him up. I shot him an email from my government email at the time. So I had a SOCOM email, and told him what I did and what questions I had, not knowing if this guy would get back to me. I mean, hell, I just saw him on TV. So what's the likelihood of him responding to me? 48 hours later, he responded. Hey, I would love to talk to you more about this. Fast forward, what it turned into was what he enlightened me on was it really goes back to selection and what cognition. These tests that I saw were part of how they evaluate how the dog learns. So the making the story a little bit shorter, but in short, I ended up getting the Navy to give Duke University $800,000 for us to get better about learning cognitive ability. And the sad part is I don't think the Navy keeps up with it anymore, because the ones that was interested in it was me and a few others at the time, and none of us are there anymore. So I don't think it goes on. But what I do use that government money for is to teach everybody else, which is where, like you said, the passion I had. So what it really is the battery of tests that I learned from Dr. Hare at Duke University was, is your dog a stronger memory dog, or is your dog stronger in inference? These are two main categories. Cognitive ability goes way beyond this, but for what we care about in the law enforcement, working dog community, training dog community, I don't care what discipline you do, it gets wrapped into detection way too much because I'm a detection guy now. So a lot of people just view, oh, the cognition stuff he shares about detection. No, I just did an entire Mondio Ring Club with these tests so they could understand their dogs better. I don't care if you do pet obedience training, police canine training. Actually, the very last cognition class I did was in New Jersey, and 90% of that class was now cops, because they're all going, oh, wait a second. If I know what this is, I'm actually going to train more efficiently. So what the tests do is these tests identify based on an actual number that we can look at. Is the dog higher in memory, higher in inference, and then where do they land? And there's an ideal percentage range that we're looking for in working dogs, specifically police, military, et cetera. And that is, I want a dog who's got a higher inference score. So 75 to 83% inference score is where I want to be at. And 50% or less is our ideal number in memory. So those two scores combined is where our ideal candidates land. So what I show every agency that I work with this on is, still do all the normal tests that you do. Whatever test that you guys use to pick your dogs, do that. I don't care what it is. That's your thing. Once you find the dogs that you like that passed your tests, which are all subjective-based tests, now let's do an objective-based test where we can see, does this dog work for what we want it to do, and where or how does this dog learn best? Is this dog higher in memory, but I still really like him? And even though he's outside my ideal range, that gives me enough information to know if my dog repeats something a couple times, he's using memory to solve the problem, not inference. So I need to change that factor so that he starts using inference, not memory. So for detection, the common thing is dogs memorize a context really well. Those, you know, I make the joke all the time. How many dogs know filing cabinets really well? But yet, how much dope have you ever found in a filing cabinet on a real search? So what happens is a dog with high memory in detection, now I'll bring it back to detection. In detection, high memory means they're going to remember the packaging that your dope is in. They're going to remember whatever those things are related to your kit, they remember really well. And then the minute when you train with somebody else, these are the dogs that went, sniffed it and went, nope, not my odor, and they walk off. And what I show them is, so if you know this ahead of time now, you know your dog is stronger in memory, the more you change things more frequently and in a shorter segment of time, you're going to make them start to understand there's more things out there. But if you stay using your training kit for a few weeks, that dog with high memory believes that's the odor he's looking for, which is the one in his training kit. And when presented with something different, doesn't perform as well. The reverse thing is happening with our inference dogs. Our inference dogs will go, smell something, go, close enough, I'll pick that because it's the stinkiest thing in the room. And I've learned stinky things mean something, or they're the ones, high inference dogs are the ones that are constantly watching that handler. They know your moves, so they're paying attention to every little thing that you're doing. So again, now knowing this information before we even begin training, we can be more efficient. And I always tell everybody, there, cognition isn't some magical thing that just makes you an amazing. No, what it does is it gives you information to help your efficiency and your effectiveness of your training. Those are the things that made the biggest difference. And in what we did with the Navy was, even though that sample size was smaller, we went from 43% of the dogs, if I remember right, I might have the number off just a little bit, but I think it was 41 or 43% of the dogs that we selected before using cognition made it from selection to deployment. When we added cognition, we went up to 76% of the dogs that we selected made it to deployment. Now, what that really meant was we were much better. We were washing dogs out before we even took them, because if they didn't do really well on the cognitive side, but they did do some things that we liked subjectively, we wouldn't take them, because we knew this, in this case, dogs with really high memory, though they could be trained, would be a pain in the ass to train and add time. Now, something that we weren't going for, but that was a result of the research, was we ended up with a 30% reduction in training time. That was directly attributed to the fact that because now we knew the dog better, we weren't wasting our time. As we, when we hit a hiccup in something in training, when we didn't get something right or we had a problem solve, we were much more efficient at our problem solving. We knew, oh, high memory, let's change stuff faster. Where before, as trainers, we would just try stuff and eventually something worked. That's what all trainers do. All the cognition tests really did was help me identify which path I needed to go to faster. So therefore, I became much more efficient. And I, it, like you said, it is truly, truly something that I think those who either procure dogs, maybe sell dogs or prep dogs for training, any of these types of fields or agencies that buy dogs, if you are the problem that we run into is I can train somebody at an agency, but if they leave or get promoted, they're out, that information is gone. So this works really well with individuals like yourselves or larger training groups who are constantly, you know, every year tasked with picking new dogs. This is something I can't recommend enough to you to understand. And as silly as it sounds to hold these different cardboard things up and to do these little games, dude, it pays dividends. You will have a much better understanding of your dog. Your efficiency of your training goes up. And the fact that you're not spinning your wheels when just trying to communicate to your dog is a huge difference in your relationship. You know, your dog's not going to get as frustrated because you can't figure out what they need to learn something. It's just like you said about the human aspect of this. It's like me trying to give somebody who's a hands-on learner, making them sit there and watch PowerPoints for 5 hours. Dude, they want to like shoot themselves. Yeah. They're like, get me the hell out of here. Just show me the thing. Let me practice it and I'll go do it. Then there's the other ones who want to sit there and go through every PowerPoint slide, read every bullet point and go, okay, now show me how to do it. So I just want to, the cognition's given me the ability to say, okay, let me look at this dog. How does it learn? And go, okay, I'm going to do my best as a handler and trainer to speak your language to make you or understand you better, to be more efficient about how I teach.
So as it pertains to odor specifically, I want to go back to one of the things you said there.
Yep.
Is it safe to say that a dog with higher memory will discriminate odor better than an inference dog that may generalize more often? Is that a fair assessment?
Yes and no. It's broad. So I'll say it in this way. So the high memory dog does differentiate odor better, but they're very specific about this odor. So the generalized dogs, let's just say the cocaine they trained on is, well, I'm just going to throw out 75% pure. The 25% garbage that's in there, they don't even really acknowledge. So when you give them, when they're searching and they find cocaine that's only 10% pure, they'll still tell you, or they'll try to tell you. That dog high in memory is going, I'm really good at finding cocaine 75% pure with this other contaminant there. And what's crazy is that high memory dog, if you give them cocaine with 75% with a different contaminant, they're like, nope, don't know it. And you're like, and all of us who've done drug dogs or just detection dogs in general have seen all of these things. I used to just call it as a cop. I was like, yeah, there's the super generalizers and the really specific dogs. My specific dogs are really good at my training aid, but it takes me a while to get them on other stuff. My other dogs, man, you got to be careful because they might false because they may pick something in their room and go, this works. But I didn't know any better. Now I know why that happens. Now I know, oh, okay, if this dog, you know, let's say my threshold for memory, I might take a dog at 65% memory, but I don't like to exceed that because unless I'm doing something like Schutzen or something where there's a lot of patterns to it, then I want the high memory dog. Or if I'm doing assistance dogs, I want high memory because it should be the same thing all the time. The dog in an operational environment where the environment is constantly changing and my target purity is constantly changing or fluctuating, I want that dog who can generalize a little bit better and make decisions on their own, right or wrong. And if I do a good job of training them, they'll make the right one most times than not. But I want the dog who can go, it's here. It's not the exact same, but I'm gonna go with it that it's here. But I have to also be very careful during my training that I present them a lot of other non-target things so they don't overgeneralize and go, well, there's a little class I do now called the cheat code of detection. And every dog has the cheat code. And in short, that cheat code is in the training phase, multiple dogs run. The odor is packaged and put out in a certain way. There's going to be a human scent component to it. Or a rubber glove component to it. Then there's the context in which the odor is placed. The odor in almost every case is hidden in some way. And I learned this by myself. One of the first times I did a deployment with a dog was there was cocaine. There was a crack cocaine cookie on a table on a search warrant. My dog just kind of walked by and went and didn't even acknowledge it. And then I was thinking to myself, I'm like, huh, whatever. But the drug agent behind me, the DEA guy, goes like, that's weird. Your dog didn't even care about that crack. I was like, yeah, why would he? It's already out. Meanwhile, I was like, what the fuck just happened? So go back to my best friend. And I was like, dude, have you ever seen this happen? And he was like, yeah, let's test it. So we take dope and we just toss it in the grass. And I walk my dog by and my dog just kind of like sniffs it and walks on. You know, acknowledged it, but it moved on. He takes his dog, does the same thing. We call up the other units on duty. We're like, hey, come by here real quick. We want you to try something. And the only dog that banged it was the only single purpose dog in the group. The only dog that was a straight dope dog. He was like, boom, that's dope. So what we learned was, oh shit, the dogs are even picking up on the contextual aspect. Like if it's hidden, it's relevant, which is why when I go to seminars, when I purposely put out a distractor, if I hide the distractor, I purposely put it in a door jamb or a drawer or whatever it is. A lot of dogs will show interest in it. A lot of dogs won't alert. But what do you think it does to the handler when they're the only thing in the room that their dog throws his head snap or sniff something longer? What does it make the handler do?
He tries to,
all the things that the dog.
Yeah, he tries to convince the dog that that's it.
So then the handler goes, "Oh, it's got to be." When I can take the exact same item and just lay it in the environment, out in the open, the dog will sniff it and move right along. And I said, so what is the difference? Because how this really came about was there was actually here in California, there's a canine competition. They had to put the drugs and the bombs in the same area. And a large number of the drug dogs and bomb dogs alerted to the other substances. And I had handlers calling me up going, oh my gosh, I got to proof my drug dog off explosives. And I'm like, no, you don't. I said, your dog has a contextual aspect. It knew the containment, which was a canvas or a nylon pouch, concealed, human scent, in an area that it doesn't belong contextually. Like this room I'm in has its own smell. But the minute I bring in a target odor, bomb, or drug, that smell does not belong in here. So it's going to be salient and be different. And in training, what do we constantly do? We go and put something that doesn't belong in the environment. We hide it in a certain way. If we're not the first dog to run it, as soon as a first dog runs on it, now it always has a dog scent component to this. But in reality, almost all those pieces of the cheat code don't exist. The thing is not foreign to the space. It doesn't have any known human scent that the dog knows. There's no previous dog scent mixed with it. And it's not placed, it's not foreign to the environment. It's been in there probably numerous times. So the dog loses four of the five things it uses as a cheat code, as well as knowing target odor. And some dogs who are stronger in generalization will make that connection. But a lot of dogs will go, it's missing a lot of things that I normally have. So a lot of in my skill development seminars now, I coach trainers now. I'm really there for the trainers. I'm like, okay, set up like you normally do. Okay, how can we improve this to avoid this cheat code, and this cheat code? What can we do? I said, does every dog need to run every odor on this search problem? No. Okay, good. So how about one dog runs this area or this room? One dog runs that one. And how about the room down there that's got nothing in it? Somebody draws that number and they get zero today. They're like, oh, shit. Okay. I said, this way you're having one dog run one odor. I said, do you need to put out all your odors when you're running or a majority of your odors? They're like, well, not really. I said, but it's Thursday night training night. We got to go down that list to put the odor out, right? And my goal when I first got into detection was to get our industry to look at detection like we look at patrol work. And the joke I make all the time now is like, when it comes to patrol work, if we can light the decoy on fire and see if our dog would bite the decoy on fire, we would probably fucking try it. We'd be like, yes, let's do that. Where in detection, we do the minimal amount of testing our dogs. We typically just throw out what we have. We don't try to hide something in dryer sheets, in a cardboard box, in a bunch of other shit, let it sit there for a day or so, and then go run it. We don't try to put something in a environment or mix it with something else on purpose and see what happens. Now, I get the fact that a lot of times we can't due to the containment or the rules and regulations, but I know we can do a sure hell a lot better than we're doing. Mm-hmm. We can definitely be better about how we view, how can I put this training aid out in a way that challenges the handler or the dog that matches much closer to reality than putting it in a filing cabinet drawer or putting it in a gas cap or putting it in the door. Like, how many times has anybody for real found dope in the seam of the car,
the door seam,
with the exception of my interdiction guys? I'm just talking about our average, you know, user type level cops. We're going after that kind of thing. It's never just sitting in the doors. I've had it in the side mirror before, for sure. I've had it in other areas. But our training, because we're lazier and we're looking for a checkbox, we miss opportunities to really kind of push our detection to challenge our dogs or to give them those pictures that they're going to see in reality, just like we do in the patrol work. We purposely, this is like you said, you brought up Carlos, you brought up these other guys who will purposely put the dog in certain pressure positions because that's going to teach them something that they may face in reality. We have to do that same thing in detection. We have to be creative, look at it from what the end state is. What's our operational goal? Okay, it's going to look like this a lot of times, or it's going to be masked, concealed, maybe not concealed, whatever the job is that you do. But I need to, how do I expose this to my dog in training? And the second part is, stop putting hides out all the time in training. Sometimes do a run that's blank. We need to really increase that. The dope world needs to really increase the number of searches with zero, because your number one argument from a defense attorney is the dog is likely to respond because all your searches have something in it. Like in training, you're always finding something, and you happen to work in an area known for a lot of dopes, or a lot of your traffic stops or your engagements with people turn into some kind of narcotic find. So what bolsters that argument that your dog just doesn't respond is by having plenty of blank searches mixed into your thing. And these are blanks that you don't know. What's the hardest thing that we go through as handlers is to walk out of an area and say nothing's there. That's way harder than going, oh, there's something right over there. Because we both know, what do most people do after their dog searches an area and it sniffs a corner? What do we always say? We're like, well, so I had a little bit of interest over here. Are you calling it or not? Well, you know, and this is where Andy Wyman, I stole his saying. I use it all the time. You're either pregnant or not pregnant. There is no kind of pregnant. So either tell me we found it, or there's nothing there. It's hard to do. And I get it. I feel it all the time, you know, but I also let my ego go years ago and said, you know what? Fuck it. If I miss it and my dog, it's either the odor wasn't available or we missed it somehow. We're only a probability. We're not a certainty. And too often we operate in the mentality of we're a certainty tool. And that's what gets us in trouble. We look for a specific answer. It must be this. And in reality, that's not the case, you know? So I just want detection to morph more into the same kind of push and challenges that we do in our patrol work, those that do dual purpose dogs.
I love it. Well, I lied to you. I do have one more question before we go to our rapid questions. Yeah. And if we need to break this up into two podcasts, I guess we could do that too. And
no worries. We can keep going.
Cool. So what scientific research are you excited that you may know is coming out, or what kind of scientific research do you think you would like to see in the future address certain problems? Because I know that's kind of broad, but take us wherever you want to go.
Yeah. So the thing I'm most excited about is the overlay of technology with dogs. Mm-hmm. We definitely know that technology is not going to replace mm-hmm. dogs. So are there certain detection type segments that might get replaced by technology that dog used to do? An example I'll give is diabetes detection. So the diabetic alert dog, that's probably going to be a thing of the past the next few years because there's enough wearables now that can tell somebody or predict what's going to happen to them. Doesn't mean dogs are going to go away completely in that category, but they're going to be really, really low. But the dog being a vessel of technology, meaning technology attached to the dog, other means of detection attached to a detection dog, is something that I'm really looking forward to because there's some really cool stuff in the pike about that that I got to see some years ago, and I'm still kind of in the loop a little bit about this. I can't give a lot of information because it's either NDAs or whatever that are involved in this, but there's some really cool overlays of dogs. Actually, one I can bring up that's already out there. NYPD has dogs that on their harnesses, they have equipment that detects radiation and also detects other hazardous chemicals typically used in chemical warfare. So those are actually on the dog while the dog is still working. So these devices are constantly running. And if they pick up something, it alerts the handler through a device. Some really cool stuff that kind of piggybacks that is the joke I make. There's some technology that's going to, you and I are going to have, it's probably going to be in our generation. It might be closer to yours than mine, but there's going to be handlers here before too long that the devices the dogs wear will confirm what the dog is smelling. It's going to tell you, yes, there's substance here. Yes, the dog is absolutely responding correctly because it's following its physiological side. The AI that's existing that's wearable on dogs, the AI starts knowing the dog's body rhythms. So basically breathing changes, heart rate, temperature, these things, and it gets better and better and better. The more the dog is doing distracting odors, proofing odors, target odors, it starts knowing the difference in the dog physiologically between these three. So it'll tell you, the handler, yes, your dog is on an odor. Now, the overlay with that technology is another piece of technology that absorbs or takes in what's around the dog, and then you can scan that within seconds and say, not only do I know my dog alerted, here's what it alerted to. So those are some things that I'm really excited about. On the training side, it's also still technology. It's the stuff that Dr. Hall started with the olfactometers. I don't know if you got to see them yet in person, but those are the boxes that can have every odor in it, distracting, trooping. It can regulate how much odor comes out. It can mix odor, and it trains the dog by itself. So it randomizes which box is hot. You never know. And the dog must hold a position. And then if a dog holds a position for the prescribed time or the variable time that the computer creates, it'll beep, and the dog will know it's correct, and the dog can get reward. There's a video of Dr. Hall doing his laundry, and the boxes are training his dog. And literally as he's folding clothes, when the dog is right, the box beeps, the dog goes over to him, he gives the dog a reward, and then the boxes within 20 seconds reset, he sends the dog back again. So he literally does laundry while the boxes train his dog. So that's some cool stuff that's ahead for us when it comes to technology that's within reach, that's within the 5-10 year range for us.
That's amazing. So what about something that may not be, in production or in the process of happening? Do you have any scientific research that you think that you would really like, someone to do, or maybe you be a part of?
Oh, heck yeah. I would love to know better or more specifically, what are the dogs detecting in, let's say, explosives or narcotics? You're probably privy a little bit, and we'll get into this when we do the role reversal here. Like Dr. Furton is even bringing up the question, is the dog really smelling THC or is it something else? And let's say marijuana. And that's the stuff that you guys are getting deeper in, and we'll go into that another time. But there's questions like, is it methylbenzoate and the cocaine? Is the dog really detecting that, or is it detecting something else? And we just are saying, because methylbenzoate is the chemical there, that's got to be what it is. It's turning out that we may not be as accurate in those beliefs as we thought, but there's not where the research currently is, there's not funding to take it deeper to the levels that we care about. Mm-hmm. So I would love to see that get answered better than where we're at now. And we may never know, because dogs being different, I already know part of this answer is, well, yeah, some dogs may actually be allergic to the methylbenzoate, but other dogs may not.
Right.
And, you know, we don't know that until we do enough segregation of all these elements of the odors to know what is this dog really paying attention to. In the cop world, we'll never go that deep because we don't have the time and the resources or the abilities to go there. The cop world, we're cops first, dog people distant. Somebody like you who's also taking it like myself, like a passion, we're dog trainers, but you still have your job. You still have to put the badge on the gun and go do that. And that's your bread and butter. Cause if dog training was that, you would stop being a cop and be a dog trainer. Like, that was my dilemma personally, not to sidetrack, but I liked being a cop. I loved doing dogs. And that's what finally separated me from those two worlds, was I could get pulled away from the cop world when I got offered to do nothing but dogs and got paid much better than being a cop. So that was my draw away. So the part of that research is, I would love the cop world to have answers. I would love the cop world to know more. But the problem is, the research doesn't get funded for that. It gets funded for things like, how does food smell to be better sold to a dog? So somebody will buy this food because their dog will like it more. So olfaction gets wrapped into dog food testing. Or how does a dog react when it smells this? Does it elicit saliva so that way the human will be, oh, my dog's hungry, let me feed it. So Nathan, Dr. Hall, Dr. Nathan Hall does get some good funding, and he's good about somehow being able to sometimes overlay these things together to help us out in the detection dog community with something that was initially started with, let's say, a pet food company that wanted to know an answer. The good thing too, though, is I'm glad to see Department of Homeland Security, Customs, and so forth investing in trying to know some of these answers. But again, everything comes down to money. And how much money is there? Yeah. So to really answer your question, I would love to know more about what it is in these odors. But I also kind of know deep down, we won't totally know, not globally in the sense of where, like, I know for a fact, if I train my dog on this, they'll find this, because I've learned this now. I've learned that, here's a specific example. Up to a point when I was working with Dr. Hall and Bart Rogers and Dr. Lucy Lazarowski, for the longest time we had dogs. It was rare to see dogs hit parts per trillion, but there were dogs that could go down to parts per trillion. That was amazing. And the average police dogs don't do that, but you can train it down to that level for some dogs. Their sensitivity is that good. Now, they're the Michael Jordan of noses kind of thing. Well, I don't know how long, I want to say maybe 2 years now, but a year to 2 years ago, there was a dog that was hitting parts per quadrillion.
It's amazing.
So then I might get some research with a sampling of dogs that are telling me that in this circumstance, under these testing conditions, here's what they're smelling. But then the dog that comes in that's the parts per quadrillion dog will go, no, it's this. So though we may get some, we definitely can be better. That's, I guess I should say, the bigger thing is we could be better about getting some of that information. We'll have, we won't be guessing as frequently or maybe reaching so far in our guesses. Yes. We'll be better. But yeah, I look forward to just to be better about what we're detecting.
For sure. And I'm an optimist. And I know, and you know, that there's research being out there. I'm happy to be part of some of that stuff. And it's always fascinates me what we're able to find out. We may never know with 100% degree of certainty what the dog is smelling, but I feel like we're going to get close. We're getting closer, and that makes me happy for sure.
Yeah, for sure. And this is why I can't wait to turn this around when I get to sit down and talk to you is, and you don't have to answer this here, but I'm pretty sure you can just give me the yes or no part. But your involvement in the science community as a police canine handler, has it had an effect on how you view and how you train your dogs now as a cop?
Oh, 100%. How could it not, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So, but you know what I know, which is so much of our community is missing out on that information that you've now been exposed to that's made you reevaluate some of the beliefs that you had, that which is why I share a slide in all my presentations now. It's like slide number two. It's belief is the death of reason. And because we will believe so strongly about something that though something reasonable is proposed or even factual in some cases, we'll ignore it because we're like, I can't leave my belief. And that's a lot of the dog world in general, not just the cop world or whatever. The dog world in general faces that a lot. But I love the fact when I heard that you were part of that research stuff, I was like, thank God there's somebody else now that's going to get that exposure that will be able to relay your experiences to everybody that you work with and teach. And you're going to probably experience this. One of the toughest things I've gone through as an instructor, it's difficult to see behind the curtain. You know, when you see the stuff that you see, when you start learning there's more than the world than I was taught, mm-hmm. I'm like, oh man. And then you get excited. You want to share that. But then what do we hit the minute we start sharing it? That wall that exists within our community sometimes, because it challenges those beliefs that we had.
Yeah.
And instead of people being like us, totally excited and embracing, like, holy shit, you know how wrong we were? Look at what we can do. It turns into, oh, wait, what? No, I don't know. I mean, those are guys in lab coats and in a little room doing stuff. There's no way that applies to me. But I laugh because it's the same category of people that will argue case law over something that was in some other state that has nothing to do with me here. But it's just our community. I want us to be more receptive to there's things that have to change. There's things that exists now that can clearly show us there's efficiencies or effectiveness or just we believe this or we knew this, but there's more information now. We can make adjustments. And the ship doesn't turn on a dime. That's the thing.
I'll equate it to something that very popular videos online of kids who are colorblind and they get to get these special classes and they get to see color for the first time. Their whole world has changed, right? So I equate that to your point. Yes, we didn't know those colors existed. Now I'm privy to those colors. I'm super excited about it. My whole world has changed, but everybody else is still colorblind. And now I have to convince everybody else that I promise you there's color here, even though you can't see it. And the reason why I continue to put on the badge and because it continue to be a full-time police officer is because I find that people are, at least in my industry, are more likely to listen to what I have to say because I'm still involved heavily in that. So although you could probably make the point, and my wife would make the same point, we're probably losing money continuing to be a full-time police officer. The truth is I have a calling that where I'm at is exactly where I need to be. How long that's going to happen, I don't know. But I'm excited to maybe bridge some of those gaps and work with guys like you in the future to get good information out there. I mean, like you said, we'll have a role reversal. We'll talk about it more. So let's get to the rapid fire questions. I'm gonna throw questions at you. I want you to not spend too much time in thought. Okay. Some of these are super easy. They're softballs. Some of them may require a little bit more thought process. Okay. So number one, favorite sport?
Hockey.
Favorite team?
Golden Knights.
How tall are you actually?
6'2" and something. I've shrunk a little bit as I've gotten older.
One food is your one food for your last meal. What is it?
9 times out of 10, it'd be pizza, but I could easily go for some great fish. Like now that I'm up here in Northern California, I love seafood. So that's a broad spectrum. Last meal I would probably throw down something stupid like that.
Okay, so Detroit style, Chicago, or New York?
Ooh. Oh gosh, New York.
Okay, good answer. Correct answer, by the way. Yeah. favorite country to visit?
Austria. Now I've been to Austria. Not to get confused, because Austria, Australia sound the same. Austria. I went to that this past year, and when I lived in Germany, I'd driven through it before. But this year, I spent more time there. A friend of mine, Florian's there. Oh, so beautiful. So beautiful. So it's, and I, the personal reason I love it too is not only the beauty of that country, but then the dog stuff there is phenomenal.
Awesome. Good to hear. When was the last time you cried?
Oh, I would say, what I'm getting as I'm thinking, I'm thinking the time frame, not that when I did it, probably a few months ago, and it was just relation to dog stuff that happened. Mm-hmm. You know, just like I was reflecting, actually, mm-hmm. to be completely honest, reflecting on my growth as a trainer yeah. and having a conversation about how bad I was as a trainer and the guilt I carried for how I worked dogs in the past. And even though I didn't know better and I was just doing what I was taught, man, the level of hurt and shame I carry for, like, why couldn't I have been better back then? I mean, that's all, you know, hindsight's always what it yeah. is. But there are some amazing dogs I got to be a part of. And I was like, man, if I could just have them now, how much better I would be. So yeah, that was an emotional kind of feeling that I went through that definitely elicited tears out of me, because it's a heavy thing to think of, like, man, you know, I now know exactly what triggered it. So my last dog, Kino, was the dog I had in Texas when I was in Texas as a dog handler. And when I moved from Texas back to Florida, my best friend Hank picked him up and used him as his police dog in Orlando. And Kino passed away about 9 months ago. Mm-hmm. And that started that whole thing. It was us, you know, kind of shooting the shit and getting the ashes. Yes. And Hank is if everybody gets to anybody meet Hank Wong, he's now retired, but he was Orlando SWAT for 20 something years, canine for almost all that entire time. He's a magnificent instructor. And to share a dog with him was phenomenal, but just the way he gave me I gave him that dog to work, and the way he gave me part of his ashes was, you know, started that whole thing. So that's the whole story behind that.
Yeah. One. Forgive yourself, Cameron. You got to forgive yourself, brother.
Oh yeah, I know.
someone wiser than me told you that already. So,
of course. But yeah, it's still, you know, I always strive to be better, and I suffer at that too. I'm not good at always doing that. In my head, I'm like, yes, I'm gonna go do this. And then I'm like still doing the stupid shit I did before. So like you said, we have to let go of some things and get past it and then just be better.
For sure. And think about all the things you're doing now to help the industry. That should be the focus there,
yeah,
man.
Yeah.
So, okay.
There you go.
Well, this bleeds into that perfectly. If you could give a message to your favorite dog, past or present, what would that message be? Mm-hmm.
Oh, that I love the dog unconditionally, you know, that no matter how good or how I want them to reflect my ego sometimes, you know, I look good because of me. I love them like they love me. That's what I wish I could say, because you know how dogs are. They, you know, like, I think it's Neil deGrasse has a great little quote he talks about. It's the only species that misses you, even if it's you walking out the door for a second. You come back and it's like, whoa, where have you been? You know, so, and it's funny, side note to all of that, it was actually going into spaniels is what really changed me as a handler. After 25 years of working tough Malinois and German Shepherds and Dutch Shepherds. And it was a few years ago when I switched into I did it to challenge myself. I wanted to work a different breed. I wanted to get into the Spaniels just because I'd seen them used in Europe all the time. And I was like, why aren't we using them here? So I got one and then started doing it. And then they changed everything about me. I'm like, it made me softer in the sense of, like, this shit's no big deal. If a dog doesn't get it, doesn't get, because I couldn't look at a Spaniel and ever think, I could be angry. I'm just like, that's all right, dude. No problem. Let's just do this again. And it's so funny. Everybody who I put a spaniel with back when I was pushing some dogs a few years ago, we raised a lot of dogs from puppies, and then we would get them ready. And then once they hit, you know, year and a half old, we would put them with whatever agency. And we had a handful of spaniels we did that with. So a lot of guys that we put spaniels with had never had anything like that before. I said, I promise you, it's going to change how you look at working dogs, especially the ones that already had dogs in the past. And 100% yes was the same. They're like, dude, you're not kidding. It's one of the greatest gifts I've had is having a dog that I cannot look at and ever be mad, because they're just looking at you with those ears and that, you know, that cute little face. And you're like, as tough and as hard as I want to be, this cute little spaniel has turned me into a little soft mush, you know, that I love no matter what. So
I love it, man. I love it. All right. One last question. Is it true that you're related to Henry Ford?
Not Henry Ford. Gerald Ford.
Ah,
Gerald R.
No way.
Gerald R. Ford, President of the United States. That was my uncle. Technically great uncle, grandfather's right. brother. So when I was born, I was born in 73. So that was the heart of the Nixon period leaving. Short, long story was my uncle was Speaker of the House, and Spiro Agnew, right when Watergate started happening, he resigned as vice president. Nixon picked my uncle because my uncle had a very above board reputation. He was the kind of guy that could collaborate with both sides. Even though he's a Republican, he had a really good relationship with Democrats and so forth. And he had a really good background, like no controversy, no history. So Nixon wanted somebody with a clean background to be associated with him, makes him the vice president. Lo and behold, as we all know, history, Nixon gets in trouble. Then my uncle is now the first non-elected vice president or president put in a position that he didn't even really want to begin with. And at that time, I'm born. My grandparents, my mom's side, the first time they got to see a photo of me was in the newspaper because they had a little Ford's youngest supporter thing on my little incubator thing. So I got older, and then I was still super young, a few years old, three or four-ish. The last year he was in office, I got to go to the White House as a little kid, went to the White House. And, you know, the craziest part, the memory I have of going there was two things. One, he had his dog Liberty, a golden retriever, had just had puppies. Mm-hmm. So the puppies, I remember the puppies jumping all over me as a little kid. I remember that. I remember sitting on phone books in the White House and whatever dinner we were doing. They had me sitting on phone books so I could be high. And then on a helicopter ride with Marine One, I just remember being out the window, seeing everything, doing that on the ground. So I don't remember much of anything else, but those were the things I remembered. You know, and then of course the rest of the years, you know, after he was out of office, there was a lot of good, cool Ford history stuff. And I try to be a good steward of that now because it's me and a cousin. We're the last Ford males left. There's nobody else you know, that I know of yet besides my cousins that have had a boy that have the last name Ford. So we're kind of it. Wow. So I'm trying to be better now about that history. And I don't share it a lot. I don't tell a ton of people. I tell some few close friends. And like what you just said, a lot of people will assume it's the car manufacturer. Yep. They don't think, especially the generation now. I mean, anybody in the 30s doesn't even barely remember who Ford was as a president. So it's the ones closer to my age that know or have some history of who Gerald Ford was. So yeah, that's the Ford tie.
That's awesome. The only history I have that I know of as far as my last name is, we're pretty sure that my great-great-great-grandfather was Napoleon Bonaparte's doctor. And most people believe that he killed him. So that's probably not really good history.
So people can understand because you have say your last name. So because I always hear it butchered all the time. So
butcher it. The truth is, I say that it's Antomarchi. I have run into Italians that are like, that's a disgrace. You should never say it that way. It's supposed to be Antomarchi. I don't really know. I did the whole ancestry.com and my lineage is every. I'm a mutt is basically what it comes down to. So I don't really know.
I think we all are to a level.
For sure. Well, hey, I learned a lot about you. The most important thing is that you're a Neil deGrasse Tyson fan like I am. So
yes.
Love that man. I follow him closely. Another guy I feel like I know closely. But man, thank you for your time. Thank you for what you're doing for the industry. You have helped literally thousands of people. I think it's really important to reflect on those things. It's really cool that you had that moment. I questioned whether I wanted to ask you that question the last time you cried. I'm a big crybaby. My kids laugh at me all the time. As I get older, I cry over Marvel movies. Like it's ridiculous.
Oh yeah.
But, it's good stuff, man. So again, thank you for what you're doing for industry. It's really important. We look forward to working with you and, doing some cool stuff, man.
And I want to thank you because like I said, it's, doing what you're doing and going through what I went through, I appreciate it's a tough road to walk when very few people are walking it right now. Mm-hmm. And that means like understanding what's happening in our detection community. I think you can definitely agree with this. We are in a detection renaissance mm-hmm. period, which means there's lots of new things happening, and some of which we don't understand, some of which we do. And for some it's scary, for some it's embracing, like it's exciting, like for us. So I really appreciate now I have another brother in there and other people that are in this march together to do what we can just to become and continue to be better at what we do with our dogs when it comes to detection. So I thank you for taking that step forward to diving in, because I'm sure for you, like it was for me, it's intimidating being around all those doctors. And at first they start talking about protocols and all that crazy stuff. But you stuck with it. So I really look forward to what you end up bringing to the community and sharing with it as well. So thank you, man.
I know some really awesome things are going to come out of it. And I think it's just the tip of the spear, if you will. I think there's going to be more opportunities. I think those relationships are really important. I think that local police trainers should reach out to these chemists and these doctors and develop those relationships, because we're on the same team. You say we're in a renaissance, and I know that this book probably is familiar to you because
it's right over the shelf.
And you had actually said that right in the back. So anyway.
Oh, I forgot. Actually, I totally forgot that's on there.
You put that exactly there. I try to be a good student and a good steward of information. But thanks again, Cameron, for the listeners. I hope that you like the format. We kind of throw everything at you. There's a lot of information. Hopefully someone will get something out of this.
Absolutely. And I thank everybody for watching and listening, and stay tuned. And thank you for joining Canines Talking Sense, where it's okay to be nosy.